experience and the foundation of every part of our Christian experience. And so the heart of the conference is really and it couldn't come at a better slot in the 5-day program than on the middle day of the conference. I am personally convinced that all issues that we face are resolved in the fact that He's Lord. The sevenfold unity that is spoken of in the Word in Ephesians is centered in the fact that there is one Lord. And the oneness that is to come in our lives must come to the fact that Jesus is Lord. It's amazing how many people contend for infallibility of the Word and are continuously making the issue of the infallibility of the Word the issue of the day. I don't think that's the issue at all. The issue of the day is whether Jesus is Lord. I was with a pastor recently in Arkansas, a brilliant young man, one of the finest young pastors I've ever met. He described his own pilgrimage, how he met the Lord, and then he sort of drifted in his commitment to Him. He went to seminary, was attracted by a very liberal pastor in the city, known for his brilliant mind, and he began meeting with him personally, and they began to, in his terms, dialogue. And you can imagine the things they dialogued about. And and he was so enamored with him. I can tell you about this pastor's position by describing when his son, little boy, came to be saved. A seminary professor friend of mine told me this. He said the little boy came to receive Jesus, and the father presented the congregation by saying, "My son has come to affirm his heritage." Well, you know what Jesus would have said about that, would say about that. "You're of my father, you're of your father, rather the devil." And if he was affirming his heritage, he was affirming his heritage as a child of the devil. So he was dialoguing with a pastor. That gives you some idea where they were, how far out to sea they had gone. And he heard some tapes by Manly Beasley. Well, he had never heard anything like that. That was something to dialogue over. And when he heard the truth, he received the truth. Well, the amazing thing was that in the process of the Lord's moving, he came to know the Lordship of Jesus. And in the Lordship, he came to know, of course, the filling of the Spirit and the flow of the Lord through his life. Well, I can tell you, he doesn't have any liberal tendencies in any way. He believes all of the Bible, including the cover, which says, "Holy Bible." But you can get a man straightened out on whether he believes the Bible or not, and him still not be where he needs to be. But you get a person straightened out at the point of the Lordship of Christ, and the other issues simply go by the boards, because the Lordship of Christ is the issue. And so that's where our focus is today, upon His Lordship. Now, when you commit yourself to somebody unconditionally, you need to know two things about them, I believe. You need to know, first of all, if they love you. And then you need to know if they have enough power to do you any good. Because when you get committed to somebody totally, unquestionably, irrevocably, they better love you. They better have your best interests at heart. And then when you get committed to somebody in those terms, they better have the ability to do for you what they desire to do on the basis of that love, if they have your best interests at heart, and they don't have any power to do anything about it, you're not really much better off, however much help they may have wanted to give you. If they can't give you that help, you're still left in a strait. And I am personally convinced that our biggest problem as Christians is we have a fear that Jesus doesn't love us unconditionally, doesn't love us completely. And then we have a suspicion that maybe his power is kind of waning a little bit, that handling all the complexities of the day that he's faced with, maybe his power is lessened in some way, and that resilience of his power has somehow diminished. And there are a lot of people who come right up to the edge of a total commitment to the Lord, and they really wrestle with this matter: can I trust Jesus completely? I remember sitting one day in an evangelism conference in Louisiana with a very popular conference speaker, a seminary professor, not from the one and only in Fort Worth, but another. And as we talked about Jesus being Lord of the life, he looked at me across the breakfast table with piercing eyes, but with a total candor and honesty, he said, "Jim, I'm afraid. I'm really afraid to unconditionally surrender to the Lord." He said, "I'm afraid of what will happen, afraid of what it'll cost me." Well, I can understand that. I remember for many years in my life, that's pretty close, Jerry. I mouthed the phrases about the Lordship of Christ. And I gave some verbal credence to the fact that he's Lord. If anybody had asked me if he was Lord, of course I would have said he's Lord. And I could tell those thrilling stories, you know, of people who stood on the hillsides and shouted, "He is Lord," or "He is risen from the dead, He is Lord." And I could say all those moving stories. But then when it came down to that total surrender, the absolute capitulation on my part, I had trouble. And I would reserve just enough of myself so if the Lord didn't come through, I could get back into the act myself. And I would keep just enough of myself in reserve so that I could implement my own activities and my own energies at any given course. And so when we come right up to this point of his Lordship, there are a lot of questions that begin to zoom around in a thoughtful mind. And we begin to ask ourselves, can he be trusted? Can we really expect him to do better by us than we would have done by ourselves? And so in this first message, I want to invite you to John's Gospel, John's Gospel, chapter 5, and I want you to hear Jesus' affirmation of his Lordship, and then I want you to see Jesus' illustration of his Lordship. First of all, his affirmation. If you will begin with me in verse 17, you will find that at this point in Jesus' life and ministry, and I've been preaching through the life of Christ now for well over a year in Lake Country, and will preach through the life of Christ until I preach through the Gospels. And Jesus is getting in holy hot water at this point as far as the religious community is concerned, because of the claims that he's made about himself. In verse 17, says that Jesus answered them, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work." Now the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Now I want you to know that Jesus never had any problem with his self-image. He never, ever had any difficulty knowing exactly who he was. Now, one of our problems as Christians is that we do have a problem with self-image. And the thing that Jerry was sharing with us last night will be resolved when the mind of Christ begins to be operative in us. And that classic message, I'll never forget that message, on the mind of Christ being our mind, brings us into a proper self-image. The people of God today suffer from a tremendous, tremendous conflict in their self-image. And once we understand who we became in Jesus, our self-image is immediately corrected. I remember a professor once in a university where I was teaching the truth of the death to self coming to me and saying, I have a problem with your teaching. And he wasn't the first person that had ever had that problem. And he wasn't the first person to ever acknowledge it. He said, how do you reconcile what you're teaching about the death to self and the fact that we're to love ourselves and we're to have a wholesome, healthy self-image? And I said, well, I don't have any problem reconciling at all. What I am in my nature would never let me have a good self-image. I have the tendency to lie. I have tremendous ego. I have lust. I have every conceivable thing in me. And how could I love me knowing what I am? You know, I've had some people say some unkind things about me. I don't know whether you've ever had anybody say anything unkind about you or not. But I complained to the Lord about that one time. I said, Lord, I'm such a nice guy. Why would they say that about me? And he said, if they really knew you, they'd really have some ammunition. So he reminded me that nobody has ever said anything as bad about me as I am. But that part of me died. So I don't have to worry about that part of me. I'm dead. But a new me stood up. A new self emerged in me. And I am just very relaxed with this new self, Christ in me. And I remember being in India, and we were being briefed about how to meet Madam Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of that country. And we were being told how we were to respond to the head of state and all this sort of thing. And I decided that maybe I ought to get nervous. I was just as relaxed as I could be, and I thought, you know, this isn't fair. I should feel something. And it suddenly occurred to me, why should I be nervous about meeting the head of state of India when I was a child of the king? Now, I don't know whether Madam Indira Gandhi got nervous when she met the child of a king or not. but my self-image, you see, was immediately put in proper perspective when I died and a new me stood up, Christ in me. Now, you understand that I'm not Christ and Christ is not me, but Christ has chosen to identify himself with me so that for me to live is Christ. And you can't, the amazing thing about the vine and the branch is that you can't really tell where the branch starts and the vine stops or vice versa, because they become one, don't they? And yet, while they are one, they are distinctive. Now, I'm not really going where I meant to go, but I'm going in an interesting area, so let me just go a minute, okay? Jesus had a proper self-image. He said, he that hath seen me hath seen the Father. Now, his identity was such that he was uniquely and separately the Son of God, yet he was such an extension of the Father that he saw himself as the Father and the Father in him. That's exactly the image that we are to have as Christians. We are unique in our individuality, and none of us are a genetic accident running around, but we are that unique person which God has determined we are to be. That's why when we put one another down, we are really putting God down. There is not a single person in this building who is on the basis of what they chose to be. We are what God chose us to be. There's nobody here who chose to be who they are. Did you choose to be who you are? Did you call ahead and say to your dad and mother, "Now I'm coming, and I have a wonderful idea what I ought to be when I get there"? We all became what God planned we would be. Now, when we put each other down, we really put the Lord down. Because every person has been made after the design of the Lord Himself. He thought us up, and He chose that we would be who we are. So when Jesus said that He was equal with the Father, He understood that He was God. And He understood His own lordship, and He was very comfortable in it. I tell you, Jesus was very comfortable being Lord. And He was so relaxed in being who He was that He could affirm who He was in this passage. Now, let's see what He said about Himself. He said, first of all, that He was equal with the Father in working. Jesus said unto them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of Himself, but what He seeth the Father do. For whatever things He doeth, these also doeth the Son in the same manner, equal in working with the Father." Secondly, He was equal in knowing. Verse 20. He said, "The Father loveth the Son, and He showeth Him all things that He Himself doeth, and He will show Him greater works than these, that you may marvel." Jesus said, "I know what I'm shown, and the Father, because He loves me, is showing me." He said to His disciples one day, "I'm not calling you servants anymore. I'm calling you friends. For a servant doesn't know what his master is doing, but a friend does. And I'm disclosing to you, I'm letting you in on everything that I'm doing, everything I'm proposing." Jesus was equal in His knowledge with the Father because the Father was disclosing to Him the choices He was making for His life. Then in verse 21, "As the Father raiseth up the dead and giveth them life, even so the Son giveth life to whom He will. For the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son, that all men should honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He that honoreth not the Son honoreth not the Father who hath sent Him. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on Him that sent me hath everlasting life, and shall not come into judgment, but is passed from death unto life. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live." He was equal in honor. Verse 23, "All men should honor the Son." That individual who says he believes in God and doesn't believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God doesn't believe God. You cannot honor God without honoring Jesus as the Son of God. He's equal in honor. Then He is equal in His regenerating power. Jesus says in 24 and 25, "The hour is coming and was present, when the dead would hear the voice of the Son of God and would live. For Jesus came to call dead men, that is, those dead to God, into life. And those who were dead in trespasses and sins were hearing Him and coming to life." Then verse 26, "He is equal in existence. As the Father hath life in Himself, so hath He given to the Son to have life in Himself." I tell you, you can pursue that all day. The very life of God, eternal, never did begin, never will end, the eternal aspects of God were in Christ, so that he is Alpha and Beta? No. Not the first and the second. He is from beginning to end, from the first through the last. And he is equal in existence. As long as God exists, Christ will exist. As long as Christ exists, we will exist, because we have life in him. And do you realize that everything that characterizes Christ characterizes you, because now you have moved into a merger and union with him? You are also equal in existence with him. Equal in existence in longevity, because you have come into eternal life. Some of you aren't too excited about that. Some of you want to think it over. And hath given him authority, verse 27, to execute judgment also, because he's the Son of God. Jesus saw himself equal in judging. Equal in judging. The Father who had judged now had committed that same posture of judgment unto the Son, to execute judgment, because he's the Son of Man. Then verse 28, he is also equal in his resurrecting power. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave will hear his voice and will come forth. They that have done good under the resurrection of life, they that have done evil under the resurrection of damnation. Here he is, equal in his ability to restore the dead. And of course, he later demonstrates that. Then he is equal in his executive ability. Verse 30, I can of mine own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just, because I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father who has sent me. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another that beareth witness of me, and I know that witness which he witnesseth of me is true. And then, of course, he cites John as the first witness. Then verse 36. But I have greater witness than that of John, for the works which the Father have given me to finish, the same works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father hath sent me. So he was equal with the Father in his executive ability. And the works which flowed through his life bore testimony of his lordship and of his being. Now, I want you to see not only the affirmation of his lordship, but secondly, the illustration of his lordship. Today in the services, each of us are going to face the question, will we commit ourselves unhesitatingly and unreservedly to his lordship? So we need to understand who we're committing ourselves to. And if you will turn to John chapter 2, I want you to see Jesus' ability as Lord to handle our disappointment. He is Lord of our disappointment. The Robinsons are preparing for a wedding. The Hiltons are preparing for a wedding. And we are conferring one with the other. The Robinsons go first, and so we will see if they make any mistakes and try to correct. We'll have 1 week in which to correct. We're both families are excited, because God has done a work in waking our children up to a chosen companion, just like God woke Adam up and there Eve was. So one day he woke our children up and their companions for life were, and they suddenly knew it. And so I don't suppose there's anything more exciting than a wedding. I can't really think of anything more exciting than a wedding. And in Jesus' day, they were even more exciting than now, because they knew nobody stood there taking their vows with their fingers crossed. It is for life. And they knew it was going to last. In fact, breaking an engagement then was more serious than breaking the wedding vows have become in our culture. And it was so exciting. It was beautiful. God had so arranged weddings that they recognized Him in it. And so weddings were such marvelous festivities. And people just came from everywhere. And they just looked forward to it as the greatest event on the social calendar. And so you can imagine at that wedding where Jesus was a guest that everybody was so disappointed when suddenly what promised to be such a wonderful occasion became such an extreme embarrassment when the delicious beverage they were drinking suddenly drained dry and was no more. What disappointment. Have you ever been to an event like that? You went to something expecting so much and got so little. Have you ever been to church when it was like that? You went for so much and got so little. And isn't it disappointing? Now, you know, there's an amazing thing about life. You don't live very long till you're disappointed, do you? And you can never live long enough to outdistance disappointments. Have you noticed that? And I am amazed at how many people late in life will come to me carrying a heavy, heavy burden of disappointment. And I am amazed at how early in the experience of a child disappointment stalks the child and overtakes the child. A disappointment is an appointment God has made. And Jesus illustrated that He was Lord of disappointments when at that wedding He changed role. He went there as a guest. He left there as the host. He moved from being a guest to being the host when He was permitted to take charge. For in the midst of their heightened disappointment, Jesus took over and He began to serve. When He went there, they were serving Him. When He left there, He was serving them. And He became the Lord of that event, and He turned their disappointment into a delight because they tasted a beverage more delicious than anything they had ever savored. And He absolutely reversed every social standard they had ever known. And it's just like Jesus to do it so different than we've ever done it, that we are amazed that He could do it with such ease and such finesse. And as He changed the disappointment into a delight, He converted what would have been a stumbling block into a stepping stone. And every event in your life that is disappointment will either be the means of you stumbling downward or you stepping upward. And it depends on how you respond to it. If you respond by you gripping it and handling it yourself, it'll be a stumbling block. But if you respond by giving it to Jesus and letting Him be the host, not you doing it for Him, now Him doing it for you, and Him being the host, it'll become a stepping stone. So He was the Lord of disappointment. Now if you will turn to John chapter 6. John chapter 6. Verse 5 says that when Jesus lifted up His eyes, He saw a great company come to Him. And He said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" And this He said to test him, for He Himself knew what He would do. Now that is a very interesting insight. Here was Philip in class. Jesus was conducting class again, and He said to Philip, we got a major problem. Look at all the people. And where are we going to get money to buy bread? And he already knew, but he wanted Philip to get in on it. And Philip flunked the test. Philip was in that third of the class that makes the upper two-thirds possible. And have you ever been there? He took a test, and he flunked it. And Philip said, well, 200 pennies worth or bread wouldn't be sufficient, that every one of them may take a little. And then one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, reported in and said, well, we got to start. 5 loaves, 2 fishes. And then he butted himself right out of the blessing. He said, but what are these among so many? Have you ever gotten right on the edge of believing the Lord and then butted yourself out of it? But you got to be reasonable. But God wants us to do the sensible thing, doesn't he? But we've never done it this way before. And we insert that little clause. We got to start, but what's that among so many? Now, can't you just see Jesus moving up and down, wringing his hands in despair? You can't? I'm glad you can't. Because he didn't. Now, what had happened? They had a deficiency. They had a deficiency of money. You ever had that? They had a deficiency of food. Most of us have never had that. But the biggest problem was they had a deficiency of faith. Boy, faith. Faith was a prized commodity, and they didn't have much of it. Now, what did Jesus do in the midst of all that? He just told them to seat the people in an orderly way, and he took the loaves and the fishes, and he broke them. He had to break them, you see, to get into them. And then he blessed them. And when he blessed them, he made himself part of them. And he can't get into anything that he hadn't broken. And when he gets into anything, it's adequate. And so he got into 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and guess what? When he got into them, they were enough. In fact, they were more than enough. Everybody there ate all they wanted. And the deficiency was met with his adequacy. Now, I can tell you that every one of us are deficient. I have never met a person in this earth that doesn't have deficiencies. And the greatest area of deficiency in our lives is the spiritual realm. Our righteousness, that's the best thing we've got going, isn't it? Our righteousness in the sight of God's filthy rags. And God's quality control system looks at the best thing about us and evaluates it as filthy rags. We're deficient. Now, we don't like to admit our deficiency. We have a hard time saying what Jesus said, and he said it with just complete ease. The Son can do nothing of himself. He had no problem at all with himself. Jesus was so at home, so at ease with himself. He could acknowledge that in himself he could do nothing, and yet in the power of the Father in him he could do everything. Completely at ease with that. Now, when we learn the same principle, that our deficiency is an opportunity for God's adequacy to be made manifest, then God's own adequacy will flow right into deficiency, and it is amazing how well adequacy fits in deficiency. And the reason we have deficiencies is so God's adequacy can be demonstrated. And Jesus, in the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes, was adequate. Now then, if you will look at the following verses in 15. Boy, back to back, these events took place. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come to take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. It's rather hard to make a king a king. And when the evening was come, his disciples went down to the sea, and they entered into a boat, and they went over the sea to Capernaum. And it was dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew, so that when they rowed about 5, 20, or 30 furlongs, they saw Jesus walking on the sea, drawing near to the boat. And they were afraid, and he said unto them, It's I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they went. Now, here were the disciples in a time of defeat. Mark's account is even more graphic in 6:45 through 52. And in that account in Mark's gospel, the word points out that these disciples rode with unbelieving hearts. Now, they rode along in the night with souls as dark as the night. The old mystics refer to this as the dark night of the soul. And I want to say to you today that no individual that embarks upon a journey with Jesus through life, with him being undisputed Lord, will be removed from the dark night of the soul. Sooner or later, you will move through a testing time in your journey in which there will be nothing but the presence of Jesus given you on the basis he has promised to be present with you, with no outer verification that he is adequate in the dark night of the soul. And you will move oblivious to feelings, oblivious to experience, oblivious to everything the mind can know and fathom, with one fact before you only, that he's Lord, you trusting him. And while there's no evidence that could verify it, support it, encourage you in it, he's going to be adequate. And you move through the dark night of the soul. And I've never known anybody who walked with God who did not go through the dark night of the soul. But let me tell you, he's adequate in the dark night. For I want you to see what happened. Jesus saw the disciples in that state of mind, despairing. And he got to them the quickest way he'd get there. And the quickest way he'd get there was to make a sidewalk out of the sea. And he just kind of strolled out across the sidewalk, which he had improvised with the sea. And there he was. Now all they did was let him in the boat. It's interesting. Scripture says they received him in the boat. That's all we have to do. When we're in the dark night of the soul, all we have to do is receive him. Just receive him. And then the boat got immediately to the bank. That's the second miracle. It's theologically a horizontal translation. It was shot from one point to the next. Now that's where they needed to get. They were trying to get to the bank. And they got where they needed to get in a split second. Jesus got in the boat, and the boat got where it needed to get. And that's exactly what happens when we let Jesus come in and get where he needs to be so we can get where we need to be. Now, when you see him adequate in a time of defeat, you realize you can trust him. Now look at chapter 9. Jesus came by, and he found a man blind. Now, the man had a problem. He couldn't see. Probably he could tell whether it was daylight or dark. Most blind people can. And Jesus went over and did an unusual thing. He spit in the dirt, and then he kind of made a plaster of Paris, and he just covered the man's eyes. Now, the man already had a problem. When Jesus got through with him, it was worse. Isn't that right? You see, he couldn't even tell then whether it was daylight or dark. His eyes were coated with mud. Now, you see, many times the way up is down. And things have to get worse before they can get better. Now, what was Jesus doing? He was working out a process in this man's life where he could trust him, not on the basis of evidence, but on the basis of him being trustworthy. Now, there wasn't any evidence at all in that mud that he was going to be healed, I can just tell you. There wasn't anything about the mud in his eyes being reasonable. There wasn't anything in that mud that encouraged his faith from a humanistic and intellectual standpoint. And Jesus put mud in his eyes and told him to go wash it, and undaunted. He didn't even hesitate. He just did what Jesus said to do. Didn't make sense. The mud in his eye didn't feel good. And his sensitivity to feel was heightened. And that mud would have bothered him far more than it would bother you and me because of the tremendous sensitivity that he had developed. Because he couldn't see, he could feel. And that sense was heightened. And it didn't feel good. There wasn't anything about the experience that was pleasant or meaningful, but he did exactly what Jesus said to do, unquestioning in his faith, and he went and washed. And as soon as he had washed the mud out of his eyes, the trip back was unlike any trip he had ever taken. He just came back seeing what he had never seen. Every flower that bloomed blushed for him. Every bird that he had heard, he could see. The grass that waved to him. The trees that stood above him were a canopy covering him. He had never seen them. All he had done is fumble around feeling their trunks, and there they were, arching above him. There was more than a trunk. There were branches and leaves. He had never seen the blue of the sky. Can you imagine what the trip back was like? Now, what do we do with disease? We don't live very long until disease comes. What do we do with disease? We give it to Jesus. You know today that if you come here sick, we have the right to come to Jesus. We have the right to believe him for healing. If he chooses to heal us, it'll be to his glory. He can do it instantaneously. He can do it progressively. He has given us medical science. And we have the right to receive the skills of physicians. And we have the right to claim his healing power through the skills of physicians.